Well, hello and a very good evening, and welcome to On the Front Foot for the last time in the summer of 2017. Summer, it's really well into autumn, but with the county championship still going and boiling up to a climax, we thought another cricket chat show would serve us all well on this Tuesday, the 26th of September. Tim Bowling's here, as usual, in the co-pilot's seat. We'll be chatting to Tim in a moment. And our guests this evening, two club chairmen. Mike Trowbridge is here from Burgess Hill in Sussex to talk about the general situation of the game. And my goodness me, there's quite a lot to talk about this evening. Paul Howard from Outwood, a bit nearer home, is with us after 8 o'clock to chat about the club's fortunes this year in the Kent Village Cricket League. And perhaps to look ahead a little bit to what's happening in the Ashes. And we've also got Mr. 173 from Merstham looking in before the end of the show. That's Laurie Nicholson. Now, as per usual, we don't have a telephonist or a production assistant, so please don't call the studio in the next couple of hours. You can text us, 07480 025 010. You can email studio at susieradio.com, or you can tweet us at susieradio. My apologies again to Chris Dixon, whose email we failed to pick up a fortnight or so ago. Chris, we'll be with you before we do anything else on the show tonight, after we've had a quick chat to Tim and a quick chat to Mike. Tim, good evening.
Good evening, David. How are you?
How are things with you, more to the point?
Very good, thank you. Very good.
A busy cricket news day.
Yes, lots of things going on today, some of which we can't really talk about, but lots of stuff going on.
Mike Trowbridge, chairman of Burgess Hill, welcome to Susie 103.4.
Thank you very much indeed. Good to be here.
It's absolutely excellent to have you here. Have you been following the news today, Michael?
I have. I've been trying to keep up with it. There's a lot going on there. So, as you say, how much we can talk about, we'll see.
Well, you being a Sussex man through and through these days, we should have an opportunity to talk about the Sussex Club and ask you a little bit about Burgess Hill. But before I do anything else this evening, gentlemen, I just want to go to Chris Dixon, who emailed the last show and asked us whether Sir Geoffrey Boycott was in fact in line for a knighthood, as there was a rumour to that effect. And Chris says he'd like to know more about the phrase the corridor of uncertainty. So you may be interested in this as well, gentlemen. I've only nicked it off a website, I fear. The corridor of uncertainty, the narrow line on and just outside a batsman's off stump, is derived from the opinion that this is the area in which the batsman struggles most to determine whether to play forward or back, or whether or not to leave the delivery. The first recorded use of the phrase is often perhaps wrongly credited to Geoffrey Boycott, commentating on England's 1990 tour of the West Indies. There are earlier claims to coinage, including a televised interview with Merv Hughes, who says Alan Border instructed him to bowl the corridor of uncertainty in the 88-9 West Indies tour of Australia. And among other references online, one that predates Boycott's claim by several months is an article from The Age, July the 11th, 1989, where Martin Blake attributed it to Terry Alderman, who rarely strayed from the corridor of uncertainty that Alderman himself coined several years ago. There appears to be no current intention to offer Boycott a knighthood, in spite of his being referred to informally for many years as Sir Geoffrey. A recent un-PC on-air remark of his concerning knighthoods did, however, offend many and got him into hot water. Tim, he's pretty used to hot water.
Yes, he is. I think probably of all the English cricketers that haven't been knighted, he probably was up there as being the number one contender to be knighted. However, as you say, his recent indiscretion has probably pushed him back down the list a little bit. But he did deserve it for everything that he's done for cricket, both on the field and off the field.
Geoffrey Boycott, Mike, never knowingly understated.
Indeed. But yes, I think on balance, I think he warrants it. I totally agree with you, Tim.
Well, there we have it, and that's all that I can find out, Chris, so I hope that answers your query at least. Now, we've got Mike for a full hour, so lots and lots to talk about, but before we talk about anything else, Michael, Burgess Hill didn't avoid the drop.
No, they didn't, and, yeah, a strange season in many ways. I guess, on balance, they suffered from inconsistency of selection. There were a lot of unavailability, which we can come back to later, actually, as to why that was. But in the end, only won four games. Bizarrely, the games they won were against sides which were right up at the top. So it was an extraordinary season. What they failed to do was capitalise against the second 11 teams which were in the division. So, yeah, we finished bottom, having beaten the top side on the last game of the season, which was Hayward's Heath.
Tim, it's interesting, isn't it, that we were talking a fortnight ago to Lewis Hatchett from East Grinstead, who won the Sussex Premiership, and availability was clearly the key issue.
Yes, the big difference I have with East Grinstead, that, you know, he said, was that each week they had a core of players that they were able to pick. They kept that throughout the entire season, and it made such a massive difference for them, and it was clear that that really pushed them to the title.
Yeah.
It's amazing how often clubs suffer when they just have to change that 11 every single week.
Exactly right. It was just a bizarre season in the sense that we'd lost some senior players, which then rippled through all the teams, which affected it. But also, week on week, there was an incredible amount of weddings and stag do's, which increasingly seem to take up weekends these days, and that just left us in a situation where we just three or four changes every week.
Do you think that Burgess Hill playing fourth division cricket next year will necessarily be a bad thing?
Well, I don't think it would necessarily be a bad thing, but we'll come back to that because I've got some news in terms of the restructure of the leagues yet again. So in many ways, that's why I hesitated. Burgess Hill haven't necessarily gone down.
Well, I was going on to ask you about the further restructuring of the Sussex League, so let's go on to that, if we may.
Yeah, so I guess what Sussex are trying to do is get a complete county-wide coverage for their sort of pyramid system. What was missing from last season and previous seasons was the Mid-Sussex League. The Stoner Mid-Sussex League was outside of that. Now, they have been persuaded that, and willingly want to as well, are going to come into that pyramid system. And so these are proposals at the moment, but they look like they're pretty much there. That will then be a completely inclusive structure across the whole of Sussex. Now, at the top, you'd have a pinnacle of two divisions. So you'll have the Premiership and then the second division, which will be county-wide. Then you go regional with two third divisions, which is where Burgess Hill, having come down, would end up in in a regional East division, and then there'd be a corresponding West one. And then you'd have another couple of divisions below that as well, which are regional, and then you get true regional below that, which will be a East, Central and West. And in all, counting it up, there's something like 27 divisions.
And what's going to happen in terms of the club's second 11s who have been in Division 3 and Division 2?
So basically, that's been maintained. So the second 11s, which had come in from the Premier clubs, their second 11s, who were within the third and fourth divisions, as were last season, that's maintained. So just to put that in context, and for Burgess Hill next season, it's likely they will be in that Division 3 East with six second 11s from Premiership clubs. The West Division will have about two or three. And that probably makes sense, but below that, I was looking at it, and there's 14 second 11 teams which come into those higher divisions.
More tinkering is really the order of the day. Too much tinkering, do you think?
I'm not sure. It is more tinkering, but I think it's a question of do you do nothing at all or keep it as it is. And the issue comes back to, which I think is right, is that there are more and more players leaving the game. We lost, same with Burgess Hill alone, about five or six players, but they didn't go to different clubs. They just stopped playing. And that was happening more and more, particularly in the lower levels of the league and everything else. And that's why Mid-Sussex, I think, in the end, saw the light and said, well, hang on a moment, we've got to come into this because we are losing and forfeiting fixtures left, right and centre. So it's now all-inclusive, completely. Will that be a panacea? I don't know.
In the Sussex League, then, presumably there's no second 11 league as such. They're all included in the first 11. It's all encompassed in one pyramid structure for the first and the second.
It is now, yes.
Yeah. Genuinely, do you think that's a healthy thing to have?
There's pros and cons yet again. I mean, for Burgess Hill last season, then there would have been five second 11s in that division. What we found with the second 11s we were playing, so you play them twice, and their sides were completely different from one match to the other, to the extent towards the end of the season as well, when it was getting a little bit dicey for some of those teams. We went to play Brighton and Hove oh, suddenly there were a couple of first-teamers in there, which is within the laws and the rules of the league and everything else. But you do get that happening. Now, is that right or is that wrong?
Can the second 11s rise higher than their own corresponding first 11?
I don't think they can. As it stands at the moment, then a second 11 can't be in the same division as their first 11.
It just seems to be such a complicated pyramid structure. It just seems to me it'd be much easier just to have a first 11 league, have a second 11 league.
Which is what they've had for many, many years. And I think there was a little bit of hubris or whatever you want to call it from the powers that be, because we resisted it. And there was an assumption that the Premiership second 11s would be, a lot of them would be so much better than the existing first 11s. And that, unfortunately, with the exception of Burgess Hill, didn't prove to be the case at all. All the first 11s finished well above the second 11s. But they've not bitten the bullet and gone back to where they were before. They're sticking with it.
No, well, I guess they've obviously made the decision to go back now. Perhaps would be a bit of an admission of defeat, I guess.
Yeah, it would be. I think they also would maintain that actually what they're trying to do is make sure that the cream rises to the top in terms of players coming through to the Sussex team. And so again, their belief is if they can play at the same standard in a second 11 as other first 11s, then players will go to those bigger clubs. Well, you know, and I have my own views about that. I think that's a shame.
But there must also be quite a big jump now from the third. I mean, you have a third 11, do you?
Yes, we have a third and a fourth 11.
So there must be a reasonable jump from, I mean, the old days, going from third to second was a small jump, but now if you're going from a third 11 league that primarily is just third 11 to a league which has first and second 11s as a standard, that must be a big, big jump now for some players.
It is, and you've got quite a difference between the different clubs as to where their first and second sit. So, for example, Cookfield, who I think came third in the Premiership, their second 11 and are down in the, what would be the fourth or fifth division now. So that, for those players, you'd think that's it is a huge jump.
Let me cut across now, because we've promised that amongst loads of other topics tonight, we will take a look at the actual county cricket. Mike, what are relations like between the clubs at your level and the county club at Hove?
I think there's real efforts to actually make that relationship a lot closer, and I think it appears to be very genuine. I would say over the last couple of years, and they've made the recreational organisation fall under Sussex, so it's all one body now, and they have a Sussex Cricket Foundation again, which is trying to pull all of that together. And it's back to what I was just talking about. There's a recognition that without doing that, how are they going to stem the flow in terms of the drop-off of people playing? That's a bigger issue, isn't it? That's countrywide, but I think the bringing it together makes sense. How does it work in actual practical terms? That's more difficult, but we've seen more involvement from coaches coming out to our ground, and they've actually and a lot of the board have come out to the clubs and looked at it and watched games and listened to us. And so I think that's very healthy.
And as a chairman, you get invited to Hove from time to time for meetings?
We do. For meetings. Last year they've had a tradition of actually inviting us when a match is actually on, weather permitting. And then there's and that's been very healthy. We've seen, you know, this year it was Rob Andrew was there and gave the benefit of his wisdom as well. And there's a consistency now coming through about how they want to develop within Sussex, and I think that's good.
In terms of development, it seemed to me for a long time, and not just because I've got a personal line there at the moment, somebody I know who's on the fringe of the Sussex setup, but it seems to me that there are an awful lot of good young players competing for squad places at the county club.
I think that's right. And it'd be interesting to see how they, because Sussex themselves this year, I guess they've become quite inconsistent. We're talking about that with Burgess Hill, but certainly Sussex have been inconsistent. They've had quite a few wins, but quite a few losses. So I think they've sort of come in the middle in most competitions, whether that's the Championship, the T20, or the One Day. It's always in the middle somewhere there. Yet they seem to be trying to stick with some of their younger players. Some are coming off and some aren't. I think if you looked at Finch, he's had a poor season probably on balance, but they stuck with him. Wells has done exceptionally well.
Yes, a relatively young first 11 captain in Luke Wells, and not a bad player like his dad, who was an unlucky player, really, win more England caps, I've always thought. Well, looking at it, close of play, Sussex 5-6-5. I believe that Jofra Archer got some down at the bottom, and Chris Jordan got a big score, and somebody I'd never heard of.
Yeah, Michael Burgess, who I didn't know much about before, but I think actually started his playing and when as a youngster was all through the sort of Surrey setup. Then went to Loughborough University and I think Leicestershire, and then come down to Sussex.
With Notts 108 for 5 at close of play, 457 behind with 5 remaining, it's starting to look as if after all their one-day successes, Notts may not climb out of Division 2
possibly
in the Championship. Anyway, Sussex going well there. I think we'll talk a little bit about Surrey too, but briefly perhaps to get it out of the way, the big news item of the day, and clearly we mustn't indulge in any speculation here, Tim, but the big news of the day is Ben Stokes and a Bristol nightclub.
Yes, Ben Stokes was arrested on Monday night for alleged ABH, I think it was said. He's been released without charge, pending further investigation, as far as I'm aware. Andrew Strauss put out a comment, had an interview with the press today, saying, well, basically saying what we've just said. He was asked whether Ben Stokes would still be considered for selection for the Ashes squad, which is announced tomorrow. And Andrew Strauss said yes, that the squad will be picked based on form on cricket alone. So it remains to be seen where it goes from here. I guess it depends on, you know, whether if Ben Stokes does get charged, etc. But at the moment, it's all going to be picked on form. So on that basis, Stokes should still be in the Ashes squad.
Well, let's hope so from a cricketing point of view. I suppose it begs the question, the hour of 2:35 in the morning has been mentioned in these reports. I suppose it does beg the question of whether management could and should have had more of a role in this. And you just wonder, somebody ultimately is going to have to be found to be at fault. Ben Stokes in the news for all the wrong reasons. Did either of you see Moeen Ali's 8 sixes?
Yes, I saw a few of them. Yes, that was an incredible innings, wasn't it? That was absolutely amazing. Mind you, the West Indies didn't exactly make it easy for themselves. Drop him. I think they dropped him at least twice. But what
yes,
an innings. Absolutely amazing.
Well, we can perhaps talk a little bit about the white ball cricket that England and the West Indies have played before we get to the end of this hour. But maybe Surrey next. Mike, that's been excellent to hear about the Sussex side of things, and I think it's important. You know, we've got East Grinstead, we've got Three Bridges, we've got Crawley and Crawley Eagles right within our FM transmission area. So it's important that we don't become a Surrey-only station. So we'll talk a little bit about Surrey before we talk about anything else and have a look around the close of play scores in the county championship today. On the front foot, our cricket chat show. Hello, good evening. My name's David Jay. Tim Bowling's here, as is Mike Trowbridge, the chairman of Burgess Hill in Sussex. Gentlemen, we ought, I suppose, just to turn our gaze on the Oval. We've tended to neglect county cricket a little bit in this year's series of shows. So Surrey second in the table still as we speak, battling it out with third place Lancashire. But there's a little caveat in terms of the number of Surrey victories.
Yes, Surrey, despite being second at the moment, they've only actually won 2 games all season. Their current stats show that they've played 13, won 2, lost 1 and drawn 10, which is, when you look at it compared to Essex, who've obviously won the title now, who've won 9 out of their 13 games, it just shows you, as we were talking about earlier on, how difficult it is to get out Sangakkara and how much Surrey have relied on drawn matches to actually finish themselves second, or nearly finished as we speak. They're currently second, hopefully finishing second in the league.
It's all about bonus points, isn't it? And I suppose that's the same, Michael, in league cricket.
Yes, indeed. It does come down to those bonus points. People just battle for those all the time, and it can. I also wonder with Surrey, I don't know if they've been impacted by the weather at all there, but I mean, Sangakkara scored so many runs, isn't he? 1,500, near enough?
Yeah, I've looked it up, in actual fact. Funny you should mention that. KC Sangakkara, 15 innings, 1 not out, 1,456 runs, high score 200, average 104. I mean, that's phenomenal by any yardstick. I suppose that there is, yeah, I know he's a great player at test level in any case, but yet another illustration of the gulf between international class and journeyman county cricket.
Yeah, something we talk about every month on this show, that the gap between the county game and the international game is so vast now. You've only got to look at, as you say, the stats for Sangakkara. For a guy who's 39 to still be able to score eight centuries this season and finish with an average over 100 is a phenomenal feat for any batsman. And it just shows you the difference now and how difficult it is for players to make that leap from being good county players to being good test players.
I think it's interesting as well, Mike, that perhaps not so much last time around, but when he was first here, you saw Virat Kohli tested on English wickets in a way that Sangakkara has just waved aside.
Absolutely, and he's just, I mean, I've seen some of his innings this year, not live, but on the box, and just extraordinary. It's just his ability to, you know, treat each ball on its merits, and just in complete composure, superb player.
Even his strike rate, you look at, he's got a strike rate of 68. For a county player to finish with an average over 100 and a strike rate of 68, that's a phenomenal record, really, for a player, especially somebody as old as him.
A lot of good young players at the Oval as well. I think that the younger Curran was the guy who kept Surrey afloat in this current game against Lancashire. He was 56, not out, in a total of 201 for 8. Presumably, Surrey declared 8 down to deny Lancashire a bonus point.
Yeah, I think so. I think I think the way it sort of stacks up, that if the winners of the match, basically, if Surrey win, they'll finish second and Lancashire finish third. I mean, it's quite amazing, isn't it, really, that it comes down to a final game between the two teams that are in second and third place. But, I mean, the whole league is so packed together that the permutations of who can go down at the moment, it's still all up for grabs.
It is extraordinary. Well, overnight, Surrey lead Lancashire by 10 runs with 10 wickets in hand. So, Mike, they're in the box seat, really.
They are, but strange things can happen, can't they? I think if we look at some of the other scores around the grounds today, then there's been wickets tumbling all over the place, but they do look like they're in the box seat, yeah.
Lancashire got about last at Old Trafford. It's good to see young Ollie Pope coming through, yeah, as well as Sam Curran, and of course Tom Curran is with the England squad at the moment. Let's hope that won't be a bridge too far or a bridge too soon. If we've got time, we'll talk a little bit about Ash's selection.
Indeed.
In due course. Let's go to the bottom of Division 1 briefly. Isn't it ironic that we've got Middlesex and Somerset scrapping it out at Lords, and this time last year, it was Middlesex denying Somerset their share of the first place of the championship on the last day of the season?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it is amazing, isn't it, how topsy-turvy it can be one year to the next. You've got a team that wins the title, and then they could potentially be relegated. I think if they lose to Somerset, they're down, aren't they, Middlesex? So it's who would have thought that at the beginning of the season?
And Yorkshire in the mix as well, because, as you say, there's 20-odd points covering sides 2-7.
And Hampshire, I think.
Yeah, I mean, they're still... if Hampshire,
in dire straits.
Hampshire will be relegated. If Hampshire lose and Lancashire don't win, then Hampshire are down. If Somerset stay up if they win, Middlesex are down if they lose. Middlesex could lose and Hampshire draw. That would send Middlesex down. I mean, there's so many permutations.
So long as it stays dry for the next couple of days, it's going to be heaven on earth for the number crunchers when it comes to it.
And I think it's improved slightly, the forecast. There was a lot of rain around, but that's improved recently.
Well, Mike, even though you've dwelt in Sussex for a long, long time, and you're pretty much Sussex cricket through and through these days, you did spend a long time and went to school in Surrey too. So I'm glad that we've had the opportunity to have a chat this evening about... both county clubs. I think that's really important. Now, let's move onwards and upwards, because clearly things are going on at the moment with white ball cricket at England level. We've also had an England Women's Ashes squad announced today. Shall we just dispense with that fairly quickly, because there's only one substantial change in the women's setup, and that's the inclusion of Sophie Eccleston. She's a slow left armer from Lancashire.
Yeah, I think she's been recalled to the side, hasn't she? She's played before, spinner. She's only about 18, isn't she? So it looks like quite a good move for the women's team.
And I think she's replaced Beth Langston, who was in the squad but didn't.
Ah, right. Okay. I was going to ask you.
Didn't get a game. Yep. I mean, otherwise it's pretty much cut and dried. You couldn't. Talking about Sangakkara in county cricket just now, I know we mentioned this on previous shows, Tim, but what a gulf there is now between the international standard women cricketers and the rest.
Yeah. So it was the same thing, isn't it? I mean, I think, unfortunately, with now, that's the one drawback of having these money coming into the sport, is that you do tend to start seeing that gap widen. And I think it's important that the counties try and sort of, well, keep trying to sort of push to keep that gap as close as they can, because it's, you know, certainly for the men's team, you've got central contracts and the like, and it's very difficult for the counties now to hang on to their best players, and you just, it just creates a bigger gap.
I think also I've got a slight insight in terms of girls cricket as well. So at the counties, then they need to do some catching up, and they are trying to do that. If from what I can see at Sussex is where those girls teams play at county level, I was quite shocked to see that they were playing at quite poor ground, so i.e. the wickets would have been a bit of a lottery. Whereas this season, when I've watched some of the games, have been playing at the better grounds, and that's got to be the right thing, and they're bringing in more performance coaching, etc., which has been at obviously a boys level for quite some time.
Yeah, you're right, Mike, and I think here in Surrey as well it's noticeable that 13, 14, 15 year old girls cricket does tend to be played at some slightly surprising venues compared with where it might take place. Anyway, we've spent, as Tim's well aware, we've spent a lot of time this year, quite rightly too, talking about women's cricket on the show, so time to move on, and move on to white ball cricket. Now, at England level, I thought Owen Morgan did a valiant job of trying to defend the logistics of a one-off meaningless T20 international in the middle of September, of all places, at Durham.
I don't understand the schedulers who look at these fixtures at the beginning of the season and decide that this is the best time to play I can understand having to play a T20. They want to generate money and they want to try and get the young kids in and stuff. But they schedule it at such a time, in the middle of a tour. It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, when you've got an Ashes series coming up, you've got one day internationals coming up, to stick one solitary T20 game in. To me, that just makes no sense whatsoever. I don't understand it.
It's just meaningless, I think.
Well, it's not meaningless in terms of commerce, is it? Ultimately, it's the money and getting people through the turnstiles. And it just seems to me that if we're not careful, we're going for the wrong kind of overkill with that. Atherton said on commentary, I may have been in the most recent one day, it's been a very long season, and he said it with a smile in his voice. And with the county, I think in actual fact, the champion county game against the MCC in Dubai may have been in March. And here we are right at the end of September. I mean, Mike, I know you and I have played wandering club cricket just into October in days long gone by. I remember, Tim, vividly travelling in a convoy of 9 vehicles from Purley Library via Clapham Common, all the way up to Battersea Park to play against a West Indian side called Ossington Leinster in the shadow of the roller coaster on the 2nd of October. But that's a very long time ago. There were floods of autumn leaves, and it was really all rather splendid. The journey around Clapham Common was like a cross between the Keystone Cops and Wacky Races, but there we are. That's a very long time ago. What about white ball one-day cricket so late in September as well? And in terms of commerce, what about that Trent Bridge washout?
Well, there was a lot of controversy, wasn't there, about that particular game. I mean, the fans at the time, there were boos all around the crowd as they were trying to get the game on or not. And in the end, they managed to get sort of... You tried to get something on, but it beggars belief that they're trying to schedule these games so late in the season in grounds which, you know, potentially the weather's going to be awful. People are paying lots of money for these tickets these days. For a one-day international, it's sort of, well, last time I went, it was about 60 or 70 quid,
yes.
Probably more than that now.
Yep.
And it's a hell of a lot of money to go to these, just to see nothing, or to see a truncated game that's not really a proper game. So I think they need to look at this schedule properly. It seems to me they're just trying to push in as much cricket as they possibly can without much actual foresight as to what the weather's going to be like.
I'd agree with you. Of course, the British weather, the times when you do have a fine September, you often do. So it's a tricky one.
I suppose, overall, the umpires have done pretty well. They've obviously been instructed to stay out in light rain. But it was interesting, wasn't it, that quite apart from looking as if they'd rather be anywhere else, and we can come on to that perhaps in a moment, West Indies in the T20 at Durham were quick off the mark to say, this is dangerous, we don't want to play. And I suppose that may have had a bearing on what happened at Trent Bridge?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it may... Possibly. I think when you look at a lot of those West Indies players, I'm not sure they're particularly keen to be playing at all at the moment. I mean, it's not particularly conducive to their ideal condition, shall we say. You watch some of the players, the way they field, they just don't look like they're particularly interested in playing. So I'm not surprised that they were quite keen to not have the game go ahead.
I'm amazed that they should pick a white ball side and not include the lad Blackwood, who hit it so hard and so far in the Test series. I really don't understand that. And what do we think realistically? Not so much in terms of ability, because clearly Chris Gayle at least can still bat for all he's worth in limited overs format. But what do we think body language aspect and mobility aspect and attitude in general with Marlon Samuels and Chris Gayle in the side? And mustn't it be incredibly difficult for a lad of 25 who's a wet behind the ears international captain anyway to handle two personalities like that in a dressing room?
Well, yeah, I was going to say, if I was captain of the West Indies, they'd be the last people I'd want to captain. Yeah. I mean, both they're both great players, but to try and juggle their particular talents, and when you watch them in the field, I mean, Chris Gayle, I mean, he was playing the other night, and they even mentioned it on the commentary when there was one particular stop that he actually made, and he said the ironic laughs from the crowd because he went down in stages. His attitude towards fielding is, I just think, is terrible.
But I think he's also outwardly said that he doesn't want to field, he's not interested in fielding. Well, and then as for his running between the wickets, then what sort of example is that?
No, you know? I mean, he could just stand. I mean, he's strong enough, and he's got a good enough eye that he can stand there with no foot movement virtually and just hit the ball out the ground, which is great to watch. But, you know, he doesn't run between the wickets. He's not prepared to field particularly well, and that's all part of the game. You can't just turn up. Yep. It's not just baseball. We can, you know, it's meant to be a proper game of cricket, and I think in some ways it's sort of denigrating the whole match.
It's a difficult one. Quite why anybody would want to schedule West Indies of all people in September is perhaps open for debate, but maybe not tonight. Turning to the England one-day side, and we've touched upon that extraordinary innings of Moeen Ali's. Now, I'll be the first to admit that, Moeen Ali and to a degree Johnny Bairstow, I had my doubts about at the outset, but my goodness me, they've both come through, and that 8 sixes in 12 balls or whatever it was utterly extraordinary. What do we make of Moeen as a world class cricketer?
Well, I have to say I agree with you, David. I always was slightly reticent about thinking he was particularly world class. I always thought that he was a bit of a bits and pieces player that could do a job, and the fact that he was quite happy to bat 7 or 8 in the Test side sort of said it all. But that innings, I mean, the West Indies, you know, as I said earlier, they didn't help themselves. They dropped him a couple of times. They kept bowling the same ball to him, you know, and he was just putting it down sort of cow corner, if you want to call it that. And they did not learn from their mistakes. But you can only bat against the opposition that's up in front of you, and he did an absolutely amazing job.
I think the other thing with Moeen is so many people have written him off so many times, and he keeps coming up with the goods, doesn't he? So, and I think he's wonderfully modest. And I think he accepts where he plays and the position and everything else, more than accepts it, doesn't moan about it at all. I think that's marvellous.
Well, I guess for a captain, that's perfect, isn't it? If you've got a player that's prepared to, you say, well, you're going to be batting at 8 today, Moeen. For a guy like him to bat at 8 and still go out, get runs, and as you say, never moans from what we know, never complains, just goes out and does the job as a professional, you know, it's worth his
absolutely
weight in gold,
right,
isn't he, really?
He is.
So that's Moeen Ali, that's white ball cricket, and we seem to have an embarrassment of wicket keepers. I was reading earlier on that Sam Billings has been called up now to the England squad. That's wicket keeper number 3. Am I alone in thinking, when I started scribbling some notes for this show tonight, that watching the matches as I have done the last few days, both Morgan and Butler seem to be off the pace?
I think certainly Owen Morgan, personally, I think his time in the side is over. I could understand when Alastair Cook was captain of the Test team that we had Owen Morgan as captain of the one day. Now we've got Joe Root. To me, Joe Root, if he maintains his fitness, I think will be one of the greatest England players of all time. He'll break every single batting record, again, assuming he stays fit. He's more than capable of captaining that one day team and the T20 side. He can play across all formats. I think Owen Morgan's time in the side is rapidly running out. Josh Butler, as you say, there's plenty of other wicketkeepers queuing up now. And again, you've got an odd scenario where you've got Butler in the one-day team keeping wicket and Johnny Bairstow in the one-day team playing as a batsman, and in the test team Johnny Bairstow's playing as a keeper. And if Bairstow's good enough to keep in a test side, he should be the keeper in the one-day team. I don't understand why, you know, but anyway, Billings, as you say, Billings has been called up. You've got Ben Foulkes at Surrey.
Absolutely.
You know, and you see, so you've got, we have got a bit of a, got an actual surplus of wicket keepers now, which is good news.
You mentioned Ben Foulkes. Let's just turn briefly, and it'll have to be briefly now, to the Ashes. And the thing that struck me, I mean, clearly Haseeb Hameed, who was my wild card pick, Michael, on the last show, clearly he's going to be one of these players who is unlucky with injury. And that's ruled him out. We've had the bombshell overnight in the news, which is perhaps not so wonderful either. But perhaps more importantly, I can't see any way in which Mark Wood is going to get on that plane. He's barely bowled a ball.
Yeah, although I have a feeling he might, just because he's different and he has that genuine pace. But can he last more than one test match in a row? That's the problem.
They're bandying around Craig Overton's name tonight as a possible pick. Whether he's up to that temperamentally, or maybe that's what they want to find out under the pressure of the Australian thing. But I've got a couple of figures to quote at you before we finish this hour, because clearly the injury to Toby Rowland-Jones is extremely significant. And I've just been looking back in terms of these injuries. What do you think, before I reveal my statistics about this business of managing player workload and Anderson and Broad and all the rest of it?
Well, I mean, to me, these players should be playing as much as they possibly can. And I think I know they talk about, as you say, managing their workload and making sure that they don't get injured and etc. I think a cricketer's career is very short, and I would imagine both, well, for example, the two examples you've given of Broad and Anderson would both play every single game if they could. So, you know, I think personally, let them play.
Well, okay, let me reveal my stats then. In this season of 2017, Stephen Finn bowled just short of 270 first-class overs. He's taken 41 wickets at 28, and he got 8 of those in the last game in one innings. Rowland-Jones has bowled 414 overs, taken 53 wickets. OK, fair enough. But let's just open up my 1963 100th edition of Wisden. And I know you've got limited overs cricket to take into account as well. 1963, 12th year of his first-class career, Truman FS, Yorkshire. 1,142 overs, 273 maidens, 153 wickets for 27-17 at 17.75 a wicket.
Yeah.
And, you know, the older generation have always said you get fit for bowling by bowling. And I'm not saying that that's the whole picture because of limited overs. But what I can tell you is that the maximum number of overs bowled in the Royal London this year was 89 by Tom Curran. And the most in the T20 was Jeetan Patel's 64. So you are talking at most about 450 overs compared with 1,150. Isn't that extraordinary?
It is extraordinary. Absolutely.
doesn't surprise me at all, though. I would never have been able to guess that figure, but once you've said it again proves how, well, can we use the word mollycoddled the professionals are in trying to stop them getting injuries and so on?
Tim, not for nothing do they call it the snowflake generation.
Exactly.
Mike, Ashes, I won't go into the selection business now, but Ashes predictions?
I'm a bit of a glass half empty with it. As I see at the moment, I don't see us getting much out of it at all. I really don't.
Two fragile sides, particularly on the batting, which again reinforces what we were saying about Kumar Sangakkara, doesn't it? The way in which a class player like that stands head and shoulders. And it seems to me that both Australia and England are short of two, three, if not four, top six batsmen in this modern age.
I think a key will be, and if Stokes goes... I think he was a key, absolutely key player, both in terms of his attitude and everything else. Well, and that could be in jeopardy now, I guess.
20 seconds, because we're running out of time. What about the four-day test initiative?
I don't know too much about it, but I would say anything that reduces test matches from 5 days to 4 days is a bad thing.
I'd agree.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, from the spectator's point of view, that that's almost the universal response. But I think you may find that those commercial interests, particularly at the grounds staging the matches, have something to say about all of that. Time flies when you're having fun. Mike Trowbridge, chairman of Burgess Hill in Sussex, it's been a delight to have you with us this evening, and thanks for making the long journey.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been a pleasure.
It's been our pleasure too. It does indeed fly when you're having fun. That's the first hour completed of our final On the Front Foot here at Suzy 103.4 of this 2017 cricket season. From one chairman to another, Paul Howard's going to be with us after the 8 o'clock news to chat through outward season and one or two of the wider topics which we haven't covered so far. And then at 8:30 or thereabouts, Mr. 173 from Merstham Cricket Club, Laurie Nicholson, who made that 173 in his first game as first team captain. Hello, good evening. Welcome back to the second hour of On the Front Foot here on Suzy 103.4. An hour's general cricket musings flown by. My name's David J. Tim Bowling's in the co-pilot's seat. And I'm pleased to say that we're joined now by Paul Howard, who's the chair of Outward Cricket Club. And we'll be talking to Paul about Outward's fortunes this season and indeed about some of the wider issues that we haven't got round to in the first hour of the show. Just to let you know that if you'd like to get in touch, you can text us 07480 025010 or email us studio@suzyradio.com, S-U-S-Y radio, that's all one word. What a truly amazing performance by James Anderson at Lord's in the final test of the year. It was heartwarming, was that, in all sorts of ways, and a wonderful exhibition of swing bowling emulated in the first innings by Ben Stokes, which was equally good to see. Now it's time to welcome Paul Howard, who's the chair of Outward Cricket Club, who've been on once already this season. Paul, good evening. Lovely to have you here. Welcome to Suzy 103.4.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. And I suppose even though it was a sad event, we should perhaps just ask you how the club has recovered from the sad events of midsummer when you lost Phil Alexander so tragically.
Well, it was a tragic event, and he was someone who was taken in the prime of his life. He was just 42. And had just assumed the captaincy of the club and was making great progress in bringing the club together and building up the first team. But perhaps out of adversity comes some positives, and the club rallied round, supported each other, and people stepped up and took responsibility. So there are some positives that have come out of it.
I must say, it looked to me as if things were flourishing. I popped in very briefly on the bank holiday weekend to catch about five overs of your second team playing against Horsmonden. Mm-hmm. And had I not spoken to a native of Horsmonden, I don't think I'd have pronounced the village that way. You go to some interesting villages, do you not, in the Kent Village League?
We go into deepest Kent, yes, and I think we're the furthest west of any of the clubs in the league, and which means that we have some significant travelling time some weekends, sometimes nearly an hour and a half. But it's worth it for the picturesque grounds we visit and the very friendly village clubs that we play.
Have you got some favourites amongst those grounds?
Oh, there are so many beautiful grounds. Perhaps West Farley stands out amongst many, if only because it has a thatched clubhouse, which is quite unique, I think.
Was it a conscious decision, Paul, to head Kentwards rather than stay with the more traditional Surrey Downs or Surrey County leagues?
Well, I have to say the decision was taken long before I was involved in the club, so I don't know what the original thinking was, but certainly we're very happy in the league that we play. There's a good standard of cricket. We play two teams in the league. We have a first team currently in the second division and a second team in the sixth division, and we get a good standard of cricket and very friendly teams.
Do you think that you mentioned that you have a fair amount of travel for many of your matches? Do you think that ever impacts on the selection and the amount of players available on a week-to-week basis?
It does, inevitably. There are a number of people who struggle to travel to away matches when so much travelling is involved, and of course there is a reluctance to stay and socialise after matches when you've travelled an hour and a half and have got an hour and a half journey back. So it's not ideal, but I think the compensation is the very beautiful and pleasant grounds we play at.
Tell me, having mentioned the second 11, how did your twos finish up this season?
Well, I have to say we were towards the bottom of the table, having said that, there were a great many positives that came out of the season with the second team. We had a policy throughout the season of introducing members of our youth academy into the senior teams, and some weekends we had four or even five of the youth team playing in the seconds, and they thoroughly enjoyed the step up to adult cricket. I think the adults who were coaching and mentoring the youngsters enjoyed playing with them for their youthful enthusiasm and athleticism around the field, and it worked extremely well. And I have to say we're hopeful of keeping that core of young players together for next season. And when they're 15 as opposed to 14, another 6 inches taller, another 10 miles an hour quicker, I'm looking forward to playing alongside them even more.
I'm bound to say that little bit that I saw against Hawes Mondain, Paul, looked to me like the best kind of village cricket, as I almost remember it many years ago, the mix of ages and the approximate standard. I thought it looked lovely, and the ground, of course, at Outwood, looking as lovely as ever. Tell me what happens now. You imply that you were towards the bottom. Is Division 6 the basement, or does it go on down the pyramid?
Well, this season there's been a Division 7, but there are currently discussions going on within the Kent County Village League as to how to restructure particularly the lower divisions, brought about principally because there are a number of clubs that want to join the league. And this season there was a club that joined in the 7th division, and frankly they were far too good for the division and dominated all of the games. And there's a school of thought in the league, as I understand it, which believes that new clubs joining the league should join at the bottom and work their way up. But when it produces games which are too one-sided, I think that is counterproductive. And certainly I would favour a restructuring in a way to ease the path of clubs that want to join the league into an appropriate division.
It's interesting that you're giving us the Kent angle, Paul. We've had Mike Trowbridge, who's involved at Burgess Hill in Sussex, and clearly there's been lots of tinkering with the Sussex League, and there's going to be an awful lot more. We spent 10 minutes or so, Tim, didn't we, talking about that?
Yeah, we did, yeah. I mean, the funny thing is that you talk about restructuring the Kent League, and Mike was talking about Sussex, and the Surrey Leagues have been restructured again, and they were restructured last year and the year before. Sometimes I wonder that there's so much restructuring going on. You mentioned it earlier, but of sort of tinkering with it, whether it actually affects sort of clubs and their not so much their ability to want to sort of get on. But, you know, if you're at the basement of a particular division and you think you're going to be relegated, and then in the winter you're told you've not been relegated, you're still in that league, but we've changed it now, it's a West League or an East League. I don't think that helps clubs at all to try and work out where they really are in that whole pyramid.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, the restructuring of the Kent League, which is currently under discussion, would be limited to the lower divisions, and I think at that level, then I think more important is is playing evenly matched sides every week, rather than the particular competitiveness of promotion or relegation. I think for the senior, for the higher divisions, then that's obviously more important. But I would certainly prefer to play competitive games each week rather than worry too much about whether we're promoted or relegated.
Yeah, I'm interested that you should say that. There's an awful lot of talk in the game, isn't there, at every level going at the moment about context. Test match cricket must have context. And I think what they mean is not so much competitive cricket as competition. And there's a slight difference, isn't there, when you're talking about positions in a league table and so on and so forth. And of course, as we discussed in the first hour, the other C word is commerce, and that counts for a lot too. Lots of plans, Paul, for winter activities at Outwood, or does it all lie fallow?
Well, there's we do certainly mothball the club for the winter, but certainly plenty of winter activities. We have a winter league that Outwood organises amongst, I think it's up to seven other clubs. That's an indoor league that we play through from October, usually till the end of January or early February. That's both men's and women's leagues that we run. And then, of course, we're really looking at winter nets starting in February, again, for both men and women senior teams and our youth academy as well. So there's plenty of activity planning for the winter and next season already going on.
We had a splendid evening with Matt Norman back in the high summer. Without sparing any blushes, how do you think Matt's coped with the greatness that's been thrust upon him in the first team?
He's done it extremely well. I think everyone's at the club is very proud of the way he stepped up and has looked after and managed the team. He was already captaining the Sunday firsts and was vice captain of the Saturday firsts, and to step up to effectively take on both roles for the remainder of the season was really quite remarkable. And he's really taken to it, and I had the privilege of being on tour with him last week, and we had a great time.
Where did you go on tour?
We were on tour in Portugal, wow. One of the great cricketing nations.
Right.
We for the last 5 or so years we've organised an end of season foreign tour, and this was the latest venture. So we were playing a club based near a town called Ansiau, which is about halfway between Lisbon and Porto, and we had a great tour.
So is that expats or is that Portuguese sort of locals? Or
it is expats, yeah. Mainly English, but a smattering of South Africans and Australians and Indians as well. So yes, expat.
And presumably a fair few stories that you can't repeat on air.
Absolutely. What goes on tour?
Yes, exactly.
Dead right. You're absolutely right. Paul, have you, thinking of Matt again now, have you done Jersey yet?
We haven't done Jersey.
You really should do the Channel Islands, and I don't think Matt would find it difficult to sort that out for you if you asked him. And I'd certainly be more than prepared to put my shoulder to the wheel as far as that's concerned. It's a great place to tour. It's a great place to play cricket. Okay, so Outwood, you mentioned very briefly the women's indoor cricket. You've got quite a thriving in women's section.
Well, it's been running for 3 or 4 years now, and has been growing steadily, and has been a huge success, I think. The team includes a number of teenagers, younger women, and more mature ladies, and it's very much a social side. But this season, the ladies have organised their own league amongst local clubs. So there's been what was called the North Downs Ladies League, involving teams from Sutton and South Nutfield and East Grinstead, and the ladies were runners up and reached the playoffs of the competition. So it's been a good season for the ladies.
Lewis Hatchett sold us a dummy then, Tim, when he denied all knowledge of women's cricket at East Grinstead a fortnight ago.
That's right.
Oh, there we are. Paul, I must ask you, because we've got Mr. 173 from Merstham sitting out in the green room at the moment. That's Laurie Nicholson. I must ask you about Louis Russell Watts, who's another of my former pupils. I must ask you about Louis Russell Watts' 196.
Well, I didn't see it personally, but it was certainly a magnificent innings. And Louis is a fine player, very fine batsman and bowler. and it's a pleasure to play with him.
Yeah, useful all-round cricketer, certainly at school first team level. I was probably retired by the time Louis was in the senior squad at the grammar school, but I was still doing a bit of white coat work, so I saw a fair bit firsthand. You talk about touring. I was in Dubai with him and Matt and both their families in 2013, so that was a bit of fun. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else, any little recruitment messages while you're here, Paul? Anything else that you'd like to put on air from the outward perspective?
Well, of course, we're always looking for new players at every level. And so this year we have been running a club night, a formal club night on Wednesday night, involving nets for not only the adult teams but also the under 13s and 14s. And that's been instrumental in helping the transition from the juniors into the senior side. And certainly I think next year we'll be looking to run that again. So if anyone's interested in playing at senior level, then come along on a Wednesday evening or contact us about the winter nets. But I think the other key point for next season is our youth academy. We've run a youth academy at Outwood for 10 years now, and it's been a huge success. The Matt and Louis were part of the first intake at the under 11 level 10 years ago, and they're now the backbone of the first team. We have a great group of under 13s and 14s coming through, which will be the backbone of the second team next year. And we have the academy starts at age 6 and takes children through right through to 13 and 14, and we're managing that transition from youth cricket to adult cricket I think pretty effectively. So next season we'll of course be having a recruitment drive for our youth academy at all of the age groups, hoping to encourage more girls to come along as well, not just boys. But I think the Youth Academy is part of the future of the club, and great emphasis is going to be put on that.
And the first team were comfortably mid-table at the end of the season, so there's something there to build on. Are you looking for first team promotion? Is that an immediate target?
Next season, that may be a target. I think this season, then, it wasn't a target. It was right at the outset, then we wanted to achieve mid-table stability. That may be an objective for next season as well. I think to really challenge in the first division, there's still room for improvement, and we'll work on that next season.
We must move on now and broaden things out ever so slightly. So any thoughts, Paul, while you're in that hot seat, and I'll leave the questioning to Tim, any thoughts about the current fortunes of England? And Ben Stokes is off the agenda, please.
Well, I suppose the discussion is all about who's going to be selected for the Ashes. And some people have put their names very firmly on the tour sheet, but there are still plenty of gaps in my mind.
Yeah, we were discussing at the last. We had a show a couple of weeks ago. And we were discussing various squad selections that we thought might be made. It was interesting today that the BBC Sport readers actually voted for their Ashes squad ahead of tomorrow's selection, and they came up with the following squad: Joe Root, Alistair Cook, James Anderson, Ben Stokes, Johnny Bairstow, Moeen Ali, Stuart Broad, Chris Wokes, Alex Hales, Mark Stoneman, David Malan, Toby Rowland-Jones, obviously he can't go, Mark Wood, Haseeb Hameed, Joss Butler, Adil Rashid and Gary Balance. So that was the BBC Sport readers. Do you largely agree with that, or is there any other players you think should be in there that they've missed out? I was talking the last show I mentioned Liam Plunkett, who I thought should be in the squad,
but possibly. But no, I think those are the names that everyone was expecting. I don't think there are any big surprises there.
No,
and I would be surprised if the squad differed hugely when it's announced tomorrow.
Well, I think it was mentioned by the coach that there would be no main surprises, and they would stick with the squad which they've had thus far. With various injuries, there may be one or two surprises. I think Sam Billings was called up to the one-day squad today in light of the events that have happened over the last couple of days. But yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting, certainly going to be an interesting Ashes. How do you think England will fare against the Australians overall?
Well, I think the Australians, one of their great strengths is the mind games, and they will play them to the fullest extent possible. So they will get into the heads of the openers, and the top order, and if they can undermine their confidence, then it immediately puts England on the back foot. I mean, England have done well this season, really, despite the upper order, and it's been the lower order that's come to their rescue repeatedly. I don't think they'll get away with that in Australia, and the top order's got to get some runs to stand a chance of retaining the Ashes.
It's funny how ingrained that whole mind games thing is in Australia. We had the captain of East Grinstead here last week, who'd had a spell in Australia himself playing grade cricket, and one of the things he said, even at that level, when he went out to bat for the first time, obviously they knew he was from England, and the stick that he got going into bat, you know, you have to be very, very mentally tough to face an Ashes series, which is perhaps why they're not going to throw anybody in at the deep end, which perhaps might be a little bit too much straight away to make your debut in front of a baying Australian crowd.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, the step up between county cricket and national cricket is really quite extraordinary, and I think the step up in sledging no doubt mirrors that as well.
Yeah, I think we've discussed it before, the gap between county cricket and test cricket, which is why so many of these players, they come into the England team having scored a hatful of runs or taken a load of wickets, play for England and don't tend to perform, and it's been noticeable the amount of players that have done that this season. But we'll see what happens.
Let me just jump in, if I may, because you mentioned sledging, Chairman, and this is going to have to be our last little segment, I fear. Time flies. I'm sure all the good cricketers at Outwood are already fully versed in the new laws of the game, which start on the 1st of next month, and by my reckoning that's about Sunday.
Well, I have to say that we're still talking about what sort of programme of education we need to institute for next season. I guess they do apply, strictly speaking, to our Winter League, but the Winter League is always played in a very friendly, informal format. So I think the education programme is really aimed at next season rather than this.
Yeah, it bothers me that increasingly we are producing documents the size of lawyers' briefs, and everything is getting more and more detailed and more complicated. I don't propose to dwell on this, but we were very short of time last time when it came round to talking about the new Law 42, players' conduct, and I thought it would be worth just mentioning now that level one offences are going to include excessive appealing or dissent at an umpire's decision, 5 penalty runs for a repeated offence after 1 warning. Level two, throwing the ball at a player, making deliberate physical contact, 5 penalty runs without a warning. Level three, intimidating an umpire, threatening to assault a player, team official or spectator, player suspended for a number of overs plus 5 penalty runs. Level four, including threatening an umpire or committing an act of violence, player removed from the field for the rest of the match and 5 penalty runs.
Yeah, well, we discussed this briefly, didn't we? These new laws that have been brought in are going to have to be administered on the field by some pretty tough umpires, and I think that's going to be the interesting thing to see, whether the umpires are able to interpret those laws in a way which means that they can actually stick to the new laws that have been brought in. But at the top level, maybe not so difficult. Lower down the leagues, where players are having to umpire their own matches, that's going to be difficult to see how these laws are going to be fully interpreted and implemented.
Paul Howard, Chairman of Outwood Cricket Club, our time has flown. Thank you so much for coming in to see us this evening, and hope you've enjoyed yourself and you'll come back and see us again next year.
I'd be delighted.
Good to see you. Well, we've got one final boy of summer joining us here in the studio, Laurie Nicholson from Merstham Cricket Club. Mr. 173, good evening and welcome to Susie Radio.
Evening, David. Thanks for having me.
It's very good to have you here. And before we get on to that momentous innings, some of which I was lucky enough to see, let's talk a little bit about Merstham, briefly if we may. And you finished up as first team captain in that game in which you made the big score. Are you, on reflection and having had a pretty poor start to the season, happy and satisfied with the way things turned out?
Absolutely. I think going into the season, we lost 2 or 3 of our core players, and obviously we were conscious that a step up in standard, having lost some important members of the team, it was going to be a difficult season. So I think to consolidate our position, it is the best we could have hoped for, and I think we did really well. So there was a point where I was a bit touch and go with relegation. I think in the end we managed to win our last 4 games, which meant we finished 6th, and we were actually 2 points off fifth, I think, which technically would have been a top half finish, and I think anyone would have taken that at the start of the season.
And that was you and Merrow, the two promoted sides from last year, who finished fifth and sixth in reverse order.
Yes, absolutely. So we've had some good games against them in the last couple of years, so I think it was fitting we were quite closely matched again this season.
And judging by my experience on that one afternoon I was able to get to Quality Street, the social scene is alive and thriving at Merstham?
Absolutely. I think we've got some, again, a core group of people in that side of things as well. Obviously, you're aware that the Quality Street's a lovely place, not only to play. I think it's a lovely place to sit and have a beer after the game as well. I think that's echoed by a lot of the opposition as well. It's a great place to be, whether you're watching or playing, I suppose.
So, full steam ahead and perhaps a promotion charge next year. Well, enough in a sense of the league cricket and the club, because we've more or less done that to death over the past five shows that we've done here this year with On the Front Foot. So, having been pretty evenly divided between rugby and cricket when you were at school in Reigate all those years ago, you've gravitated into the cricket scene in a way that perhaps some of us didn't quite expect. Tell us how you got to Merstham Thirds and made those first two big scores that won you promotion to the first team.
I think from a personal standpoint it's probably as much to do with the decline in fitness as anything, but I was first attracted to Merstham. A few of my close friends from school have played there through the junior system, so William Preston, Struan Clark, they've been involved since I think they were about 12. A lot of us, upon finishing school, we didn't have a club necessarily affiliated to us, and so when we wanted to get back into it, it seemed like the natural place to go and play, and I think we're glad we did.
And you made a couple of big scores early on.
Yeah, which was nice actually. So somehow first game that they were short of a few players, I managed to get 100, which was very nice. I think that probably helped with me sticking around for the season. But yeah, it was a great team to be involved with. It was really good as well that we had the chance to all play together. I think there was six or seven of us from school in that team, so it was a great place to sort of get bedded into the club and understand a bit more about it, I suppose.
And they weren't just little hundreds that you scored in Merstham Threes last year, a 140 and a 160, yeah?
Yes, yeah, yeah. So other than that, there wasn't too many big scores, but I managed to have a couple of lucky days there.
I think there's judgment as well as luck involved. I mean, I can recall being involved in a couple of partnerships of 170, but, yeah, you know, 173 off your own bat. So so let's turn to that day and let Tim have the floor for a bit.
Well, I was going to ask you, doing a little bit of prep for the show, and I read up about some of the scores and stuff, and it was interesting. What interested me the most was that when you left school, you didn't play cricket at university, did you?
No, so I didn't play any sport at university other than a bit of intramural football and things. It wasn't really a conscious decision. I just never really got involved in the sports teams. Probably in hindsight, it would have been something that I should have got involved with, but it wasn't something that I did. And then upon leaving uni, like you say, I sort of decided to pick it back up.
So you had a gap of about 3 or 4 years of not playing?
Yeah, pretty much. I played one or two games for Merstham two seasons ago, but again, that was just when they were short of players. But yeah, that was my first proper season.
Clearly, when you came back, you felt sort of natural in the game again, and didn't feel particularly alien.
No, surprisingly, I think David alluded to earlier, at school, cricket was probably very much my second sport, so I was surprised how quickly I got back into it. But yeah, once I had a few knocks, it seemed to come back quite naturally.
And you broke the record score for Merson, didn't you? With, I think it was 162, was it?
Yes.
And then you broke it again.
Yeah.
Soon after.
Yeah. So this 162, obviously last season, then the 173 this season was.
Yep. And how was that? How did that actually make you feel when you were actually breaking the having not played for so long to start breaking records at a club you've only been with for a few years? Must have been a great feeling.
Yeah, it was good. To be funnily enough, I wasn't really aware of any records that stood until I got back to the clubhouse when I got the 160. So that was just a nice surprise, actually. And then obviously I was sort of aware of it when I was batting this time. It was something that was in the back of my mind, but again, not something that I was really concentrating on.
And how are you finding the new situation of being a genuine British working man and accommodating your sport to the daily commute?
Well, yeah, so there's certain struggles. I think I've learned that Friday nights is now time to get home and get to bed, which is probably a good thing. But yeah, it's obviously difficult getting back for nets and things. I think in future we're probably going to try and arrange some sort of nets up in London, especially over the winter, which should help. But yeah, there's challenges to it, but I think it's usually pretty straightforward.
And it's obviously very handy to have a few pennies in your pocket for the after-match activity.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I think the Merston Bar has done quite well this summer.
How much of a physical effort is 173 runs in 49 overs on a very hot afternoon?
So, yeah, like I said earlier, especially in my current state of fitness, it was a bit of an ordeal. Luckily, towards the end, I was trying my best not to run too many quick singles, which helped. But, yeah, it was it definitely felt like a bit of a physical ordeal, definitely, yeah.
And it was really the day which absolutely cemented Merston's safety.
Yeah. So, fortunately enough, it was actually the weekend before that we secured our position. But obviously it was nice to carry on that momentum, and I think it's something that like I say, we can really build on next season. We won the last four games. I think if you look at it, we had a few abandoned in between, but the last sort of seven or eight games, I think we managed to win five, which was really good. And we finished the season with seven wins and seven losses. So I think, like we say, we would have taken that at the start of the season, and it's just a really good finish and something we can build on.
And is there going to be any sort of captaincy contest for the season of 2018?
I should hope not. I think, obviously, I believe he's been on the show before. Nav stepped down midway through the season and did an amazing job and brought in a lot of players. I think that there's two or three of us who have shared responsibilities, so I'm not quite sure how that's going to work out, but I know we're more than happy to sort of work collaboratively on that.
Good. Well, that's Merston. Perhaps we can widen things out just a little bit now and look ahead. Let's just ask you, Laurie, because we've asked everybody else, whether you've any thoughts. We've discussed Ben Stokes at the top of the show. So any thoughts about the winter and in particular the coming Ashes series?
I think it's going to be very exciting. I think whilst especially probably not the peak of their powers at the moment, I think you've got two very well-matched sides, and there's a lot of factors that will come into play. The selection tomorrow is going to be very interesting. I think there's still a large number of spots that are up for grabs, so it'll be interesting to see what sort of direction they go in there.
I think it's going to be interesting as well how the Australians will play after the problems they've had with their contracts, with this whole player sort of... Well, not rebellion, but the sort of uprising, if you like, that the players have got together and demanded that all players across the sort of state cricket and earn the same money, which is fair dues to the Test players. That's, you know, they've done that, but it will be interesting to see whether that's a distraction for them or whether that's actually brought that team closer together when we actually face the Australians in the first Test.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right, and we've said many, many times over the course of the summer that you know, you've got two teams out there looking for top order batsmen and precious no rank, never mind any cabs to come off the rank. Any thoughts, Laurie? Any wild card picks for the England selection tomorrow?
I think a lot of the players are quite well documented in terms of the middle order and the battle for number three. I think someone a bit of a left field shout, someone I would like to see have another go is Josh Butler. I think the context of the current team, when effectively sort of carrying a few players, my opinion would be someone who's undoubtedly got a lot of talent. I think I'd rather see them in the team than maybe someone that is a bit limited. How you'd go about that would be difficult, obviously, with the axis of Bairstow, Stokes and Ali, you'd probably have to fragment that. But I think he's someone that's sort of is the forgotten man somewhat, and I think he's probably due another chance.
Would you have him keeping wicket rather than Bairstow? Would you have him in the side as a batsman?
The way I see it is that you could almost solve a problem. You potentially putting Joe Root up to three. You could have Bairstow as one of your top four or top five, and then have Butler coming in at seven or eight keeping. I think that's one solution that hasn't really been aired, because I think Bairstow, based on his performances over the last 18 months, would be more suited to that role than, well, I'd feel more confident than him taking that than a Milan or a Wesley even. But like I say, it seems like Butler's chance at the moment is going to be limited, but it's just a bit of a left field one.
I suppose in terms of Josh Butler, you've got to say that before the side is even selected, he's booked himself into the Bangladesh Premier League or whatever it is. So, you know, in a sense, you can't have your cake and eat it, I think. We've talked several times on this show about the fact that there's not many people coming through from the ranks of what I would call the T20 generation, the first full T20 generation. And I really can't see why you shouldn't give your Butlers and your Haleses a run in the England. You've got that, as you say, that axis of Stokes, Bairstow and Moeen Ali. And look at him surprising everybody in the most recent ODI. Why not fight fire with the Aussies? Why not give somebody a chance who can slap the fast bowling on hard wickets? And we shall see what we shall see. What do you think about this potential idea of four-day test matches, Laurie?
I think it's something to consider. Obviously, any sort of drastic change like this, there's always going to be doubts. I think it remains to be seen. The floodlit test matches still got quite a mixed opinion, but I think the impact of it wasn't quite as drastic as some people probably thought it would be before it was implemented. So I think it's at the point now when you're trying to increase or maintain interest in test cricket, you've got to consider other options. It's worth having the debate anyway.
Yeah, I suppose from my point of view, one of the biggest problems would, I mean, you'd like to go to a day at the test match and see the start of play, and if the start of play is going to be at 10:30 and they're going to ask them to bowl 105 overs, and we can't bowl 90 now without an extra 30 minutes or probably longer than that if it were permissible. So I think there could be a problem there. I suppose you have to weigh that up against the number of test matches that do finish in relatively short time. I'm sure it's no coincidence that South Africa are talking about their Boxing Day test against, wait for it, Zimbabwe, to be slated for 4 days. You'd be surprised if that went 4 days in any shape or form. Laurie, what are your plans for the winter?
Well, in regards to cricket, like I say, I think we've looked into organising some weekly or bi-weekly net sessions. Whether that be in London, I think we have also used the St. Bede's nets as well, so I'm sure we'll be making use of those again. But yeah, I think we're planning on organising a few socials as well. We've got our players' dinner coming up on the 13th of October, I believe, so that'll be a fun sort of send-off to the season. But yeah, I think that there's a few things in the pipeline.
I think it's certainly good to keep the social side together. One of the things that we picked up from Lewis Hatchett when East Grinstead won the Premiership, and Lewis was here with us a fortnight ago, was that they have clearly got a tremendous commitment to one to another in their first team at East Grinstead, and that extends to life off the field as well. So let's hope that you're able to do that. Let's look forward. Let's look beyond the Ashes, Tim, for the first time. I've got the England programme for 2018 in front of me, and we start off with not a one-off, but a two-off, no white ball cricket at all, but two test matches, one at Lord's at the end of May and one at Headingley at the beginning of June against Pakistan again.
Yeah, it's interesting how the same team seem to sort of come around. I'm glad in a way that we're playing Pakistan. They've really had it quite hard, and they, you know, with everything that went on over there, and they were forced to play their own home tests in the UAE and etc. I think it's good for them to come over here. How competitive that will be, who knows? I think they're going to struggle a little bit at the start of the season at Lord's and Headingley with the ball swinging around, and I'm not sure they'll particularly put up much of a threat to England. But then we didn't think West Indies would put up much of a threat at the end of this season, and we've seen quite the opposite. So it may be a reasonably competitive couple of tests there.
I suppose as well it's very encouraging that we've had this ECB World 11 playing against in and against Pakistan at Lahore, I think, all three games. And that's clearly a big step in the right direction. Interesting about that, to me, that no question of an MCC side any longer. ECB, the world governing body, and ECB send that World 11. Yeah. And Paul Collingwood soldiering on at 41 and another 12-month contract.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame, though, isn't it, when those sort of little traditions that disappear with the MCC and so on. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that England, when they toured, were still touring as the MCC and they were still wearing the sort of red and gold. And, you know, that all went by the wayside once they brought in the commercial contracts that they'd signed for the kits and stuff. But it is a shame when little traditions disappear out of the game.
Well, Laurie, that's Pakistan at the start of the season. Then we have a warm-up ODI white ball against Scotland in Edinburgh, and then, as if we hadn't had enough in the winter, 5 one-dayers at the Oval, Cardiff, Trent Bridge, Chesterley Street and Old Trafford against Australia.
Yeah, it does seem, now you've listed it, potentially a bit of overkill there. That said, I think the appetite for one-day cricket has never been greater. So I think it's a clear direction. Obviously, we've seen with the regime change within English cricket that the white ball stuff is much more of a focus now, so I think it's probably only right that they're playing a bit more, but we'll see how it goes.
So that's 5 more against Australia, which I suppose is arguable. There's a T20, another one-off T20. What's that all about? Don't understand that. And then it's the full works starting on the 3rd of July. It's 3 T20s for the home market, clearly. 3 ODIs, and then a full 5-test series, all against India, finishing between the 7th and 11th of September, 5th test at the Oval.
There does seem to be... it does seem very strange how these schedulers are putting together these particular games now. I mean, I guess once the ICC changed their rules recently, or it was probably a couple of years ago now, where most of the money would seem to be fed through India, Australia and England. And you can see they don't necessarily get forced to play all the other, let's call them the more minor test teams, shall we say. So that India, Australia and England, now we're going to find they're going to be playing each other much more often, which to me, certainly when it comes to the Ashes, denigrates the level of the Ashes. I think it's very sad that the other test sides are being pushed out purely for financial reasons.
Do you think, in spite of all the clamour for equality and inclusivity, as far as the grounds that they're playing on are concerned, never mind a lot of other elements, do you think it will remain the case, gentlemen, that every touring side will expect and should have a test at Lord's?
I think they will certainly expect it. I think it would be a shame for them if they didn't have it. I think it's one of those grounds where every player in the world wants to play. They want to get on the honours board. I think it's something that they should have.
I agree. I think, obviously, with what we've seen happening with Durham, going into financial difficulty, it's going to open the question of potentially opening up the games to broader grounds. But I think, like you say, I'd be surprised if that changes anytime soon with the Lord's tests.
I suppose there's a difficulty talking about inclusivity and so on. Once it was the England and Wales Cricket Board, Cardiff had to be developed, and it doesn't really look to me as if Test cricket anyway at Cardiff has been a particular success. I'd have thought one-day cricket at Bristol was more successful.
Yeah, I think unfortunately for Cardiff as well, the weather always seems to be against them. Whenever they have a Test match scheduled there or any sort of game, it always seems to be weather affected, which I know isn't you can't blame anybody for that, but it does seem to be that they've been unfortunate with weather, and on the back of that, they don't ever really seem to have proper games completed.
We've got about 90 seconds, so that's 30 seconds each for the three generations to conclude this year's proceedings. Laurie, as the youngest, who would you regard as your favourite historical cricketer in your time?
In my time, wow. I think for me... bit of a cliche, but for anyone sort of my age, the 2005 Ashes was obviously a massive event. I think my memories from that, funnily enough, would be more drawn towards Shane Warne. I think watching his performance in that series, and then obviously bits and pieces elsewhere, just sort of unrivaled levels of skill, and the way that he would the consistency he'd bowl out is something that really stood out for me.
Laurie, it's been brilliant, albeit brief, to have you with us tonight. Thanks ever so much for coming in. Congratulations on that record-breaking innings, and we hope we'll see you again and for longer next time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Cheers.
That's been our absolute pleasure. Tim, have you a favourite historical figure?
My two favourite cricketers of all time, Ian Botham, Jack Russell. Ian Botham, when I was younger, brought up, same as Laurie, watching the 2005, when I was watching the 1981 Ashes, same thing with Botham, absolutely phenomenal player throughout the 80s. And then Jack Russell, as a wicketkeeper myself, love watching Jack Russell play, always tried to take bits from him. I had my own pair of Jack Russell cricket wicketkeeping gloves that I still use. So there we go.
Tim, thanks for all your input into On the Front Foot. And we're going to try and organise an Ashes special round about the beginning of November.
Yes, that's right. Yep, indeed.
So we'll look forward to that, but for the time being, thanks, Tim, and good night to you.
Thanks, David.
And I've just got time, perhaps, to surprise one or two people. The obvious pick from my much longer experience than the other two gents in the studio would be Gary Sobers for his phenomenal all-round prowess, but I'm actually going to go for someone whose stamina we've already mentioned tonight, and if I had to pick one, certainly from the fast bowling fraternity, it would be that perfect flowing action of Yorkshire and England's Freddie Trueman, Fiery Fred. And I think if anybody wants to read one cricket book in these coming dark winter months, John Arlott on Fred Trueman, Fred, Portrait of a Fast Bowler, is the book that I would recommend you to read, not just because of Fred Trueman, because of John Arlott's peerless prose. And we're out of time for tonight's On the Front Foot. Thanks to Paul Howard and to Mike Trowbridge and to Laurie Nicholson, our guests. Thanks again to Tim Bowling for all his contributions in this summer's shows. We will get that Ashes special up and running. Keep an eye on Twitter. But for now, from On the Front Foot on Susie 103.4, it's good evening.